Bobbish.
How many of you have deployed a web application or a web server before? Yeah, presumably, right? This is a cloud talk about the cloud, so presumably most of you have done that. And so presumably, you know, when you're redeploying a web application, a live one, there's this feeling that usually you feel in the pit of your stomach that's a lot like the feeling that you get when you're giving a talk. Like this anxiety. What's going to happen? Is everything going to work? Am I going to take down the entire website, the entire infrastructure? And to some extent, having this anxiety is quite justified. I mean, even big and professional places like Facebook or like Twitter used to be, they do this, right? Facebook, about a year ago, deployed a change to their DNS and took down not only all of their websites, but even the sort of system that allowed people to swipe into the office. Quite a big disaster. So, I mean, when you're faced, and Twitter, just 2 weeks ago, locked their front end out of their own back end API. So when you see things like this, obviously, and you think, oh, if I press this button, what's going to happen? Obviously, there's a lot of anxiety there. And in the less professional settings, by less professional, I mean either a hobbyist project or else a company that has fewer than 1,000 software developers, this happens potentially more often. Very often, people just accept, because it's just too annoying to do anything about it, that there'll be a little bit of downtime, for instance, or that something might go wrong and you'll have to roll back. And obviously, there's no single solution to all these problems, right? Like a lot of this is about the application code, making sure that you test the application code, that you have best practices. But a lot of it is also about things that are specific to cloud deployments. And by being specific to cloud deployments, I in general apply to all of these systems. So I want to talk about that today. The way this talk is structured is that I'm first going to, in the first part, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the wish list, you might say, of a proper deployment system, a deployment strategy that avoids as many of these problems as possible. And the way in which I'm going to develop that wish list is by sort of going through like a couple of deployment scenarios and see what goes wrong, and then we say, okay, that's definitely not something we want, and then we add that to the wish list. And then I'll switch back and I'll talk a little bit about Nix, or at least the part of Nix that is relevant for my talk, so that everyone has a sort of common background in both deployment, infrastructure, DevOps generally, and Nix. And then I'll see how that enables, we'll see how this enables a new deployment strategy that I think is very promising. The context for this is that I founded GuyNix recently, which is a Nix CI and hosting company. And you know, I really want to make it easy to deploy relatively complicated infrastructure. You just push to GitHub and it deploys your infrastructure. And in order to do that, you sort of really want to get right in a sort of automated, simplified way all of this logic. But I think that the sort of basic idea is something that you can take away even if you don't choose not to use GuyNix. Yeah, so the wish list. Again, we can't really decide whether good or bad unless we know what good or bad is, right? Like what can go wrong and what can go right. So let's look at some deployment strategies and see what goes wrong and right. So this is a color is a little bit different from here in the computer, but I think it's okay. Here is a bunch of boxes and a bunch of arrows. In this case, what the boxes refer to are web services. It won't matter for the most part what exactly that means, whether that's a container, whether that's a VM, whether and that's an instance group, whether there's a replica set in Kubernetes, whether it's an executable that you SSH into tmux and start and leave running. It's just conceptually like a service, right? But there are a few of them and they communicate with one another. Hopefully you can see the dotted line over there in the right. That's the line between the external world and our private network. So those are requests coming from the external world. And all the arrows otherwise are requests within our network. Right? So we have multiple services. You can imagine, I don't know, this could be like a pets database, right? Where you have people, a people service and a pet service, and then maybe an address service, and the entire thing tells you who owns what pets, or something like that. Doesn't matter. So let's say that we have a new version of this service over here in the bottom left. What can we do? Well, the simplest thing, the thing that usually people start out with, is to just shut down the running version, right? You shut it down. If it was a tmux, if it was an executable that was just running in a tmux shell, you just do control C over there, and then you start it again, right? If this is a systemd service, you just deploy a new version and restart that service. But for a brief second, we turn it off, and there are requests that are going to be go nowhere because there's nothing running. Right? You turned that service off. Eventually, you turn on the new version, and everything goes back to normal. Right? So here you see. Does this make sense to everyone? Does what this represents make sense? Cool. Ask questions, by the way. So in this simple scenario, really good because of simplicity, there are these two problems. One of them is the downtime of that service, right? We took that service down and then we restarted a new one. That's not good. Another one that we have to worry about a little bit is that the previous version of the service might still be processing requests. If we just shut it down too immediately, those requests might not be processed till the end, right? Might be doing some work and it might forget about it. It might not be able to sort of respond to this service, for instance, in time. And this is kind of an intrinsic problem of this deployment system because, if we leave it shutting down for too long, then actually the number of requests, then it's non-operational for a while longer, so then we lose even more requests, or we queue them up, and then the complexity is increasing. You can have like a queue that you hold, but then the latency is also increasing. But at a basic level, we don't want those two bigger problems, right? We don't want downtime, and we want to be able to process every request. I imagine that some of you have an idea about how you might do that. Yeah?
Start a copy of the service.
Yeah, exactly. Start a copy of the service. And in the meantime, don't do anything, right? And now when this is ready, right? When there's probably a readiness check, I don't know, some way of checking that the system has really been started up and is ready to receive requests. And when it is, you flip all the traffic to this new version. And then another advantage is that you can wait for the first server to finish processing whatever request it has, right? You can just leave it running. Now, this solves those two problems, but it introduces other ones. One, which is maybe not that big a deal, is that actually doing this logic is a little bit more complicated. How did you flip this from one side to the other? The answer is usually something like a proxy or a service mesh or service discovery. You're going to have to add logic. I'm not going to get too much into what these things are, but you're going to have to add a little bit of logic here to make this work. Now the other problem is, it was really nice that we got to start the service and wait for the readiness check if we have one, But then also do health checks or quality QA manually, right? I don't know, like you start a server, you maybe visit a couple of websites or do a couple of referral requests manually to make sure that everything's working, and you have that luxury because that system is not yet connected to before you switch all the traffic over to it, you have some time to do whatever you need in order to assure yourself that things are working. And that's really nice. But it only applies to this server. If it so happens that with the new version, so, you know, if with this new version I really screwed everything up and it doesn't even respond to any HTTP requests, I'll probably notice. My health checks or whatever it is, they'll tell me. But if it's a little bit more subtle, and this service over here now can no longer work with this service over here because something about the API changed, I don't know, an endpoint got renamed, I'm not going to notice. Because these two services only start interacting once I properly add it to the deployment infrastructure, when it's too late, it's already live. So that's one problem. I don't get to test the entire infrastructure, right? The interaction between these systems. And there's another problem, which is sometimes, you know, kind of related, but sometimes I really want to deploy a backwards incompatible change. And you know, it's just kind of annoying to like always have to, even internally, I understand externally, but even internally to always have to have backwards compatible changes. It just makes any system become a legacy system very quickly. But in order to be able to make a backwards incompatible change, I need to deploy I need to change this system and then also this system, for instance, right? The API is changing, so these two systems need to change at the same time. And usually, this deployment infrastructure doesn't let me do that sort of coordinated deploy. Does it make sense so far? So, are there ideas about what we might do to solve this problem?
Use a
monolith.
Use a? Monolith.
Fair enough. Any other ideas? Yeah?
You could replicate the whole system.
Yeah, exactly. So the next idea, the next deployment system is to just replicate the entire infrastructure. And then when everything is up and running, you can test, before it's live, you can test everything, make sure that everything works. And then when you're convinced that it works, you can change the traffic and then wait for the entire system to shut down and, there are again a couple of problems with this, and this is, in fact, I think most people don't use this system. So concretely, the way you might do this is just for instance a blue-green deploy, right? So you have the entire infrastructure duplicated, you have like machines over here, you have machines over there, whenever there's a new version, you deploy. You have the blue system, you have the green system. When the blue system is live, when you have a new version, you deploy to the non-live system, and then you switch the traffic, and then next time you deploy over there. There are many ways of instantiating this type of system. Blue-green is probably the most familiar. But one of the problems that people have with this is it's quite slow, it's resource-intensive. It's slow because previously, you were only deploying one system, right? Maybe there's a bit of a startup time. The startup time of the entire system is usually more than just the maximum of the startup times of the individual components because they have to wait for one another a little bit before they're live. And so this takes a while. It's kind of annoying as well because if you believe in CD, in deploying continuously, you can get like a queue, an unbounded queue of new deploys, right? Like if the people responsible for this service over here deploy a new version, and the system is starting up, still setting up, and then someone else deploys a new version of this system, then either you have three copies of the infrastructure now, all queued to go live, or else, you know, you have to wait in some other sense. It gets kind of nasty. Also, it's kind of hard to know when you can turn off the old machines. Like I said previously, let's let the old requests be processed. But now that we have this entire infrastructure, it's kind of hard to know when it's safe to do this. Because you can ask one machine, hey, do you have any requests that you're ready to shut down? And it might say, yeah, I'm ready. And then this machine, and then you ask this machine, are you ready to shut down? Because you can't do anything simultaneously in the real world. You ask this machine whether it's ready to shut down, and it says, yeah, I'm ready. But in between, this machine sent a request to this machine, and so now this machine is no longer ready to shut down because it received some work that was already within your network. And so then you're still going to get like a request that wasn't fully processed. So that's no good. That was already a requirement. So how do you know when to shut down the system is the problem here. We want fast, efficient deploys. Deploying the entire network every time is not that. So what's an option here? So one step coming up with a better solution. Does anyone have an idea of what this might be? Because maybe your idea is different than mine, and then I'll quickly change the rest of the talk.
Okay, there's one more thing, hot code reloading.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it actually solves the entirety of the problem that you just sketched out.
Yeah, hot code reloading, I think that probably does solve a lot of the problems, but it's very sort of stack specific, right? It's hard to sort of get that to work with any system. Right?
Redeploy the system only after deploying to the API exchange?
Yeah. That's right. I don't know your name, but what that person said is redeploy the system only up to the place where the API is changed. Well, I'm not sure if I understood correctly, but I'll say what I'm thinking, and then we can continue from there. But what the problem that we had was that if we redeploy the system, this might break, and that might break, but that's not going to break because this is a dependence relationship. These requests are a dependence relationship. Think about your web application and your database. If your database doesn't need your web application, it receives requests from your web app, but it doesn't need it. It can live separately. It's perfectly healthy if your web app has run down. The opposite is not true, right? That dependence relationship is there. It's actually, if you think long and hard about what a dependence relationship actually is and means, it's more complicated than it seems. But roughly, this is the idea, right? This is a dependence relationship, and so given that there's no dependence error from this system to that system, if this system changes, that one is going to be fine. I don't need to test it again. So I only need to redeploy these three items if this one changes. If this changes, I only need to deploy these two items, and if that one changes, only that one. So this is already an improvement. And in fact, I don't know if this is where you were going. In fact, you can sometimes say, okay, actually, I don't even need to redeploy these other two systems because I know that insofar as it matters, this matters to this system, this hasn't changed. I might get into this if I have time, but it probably won't. But the first improvement is just to deploy that subset. So we're done with the talk, right? It's just like deploy those three items if that one changes, and that's it, right? The big problem here is that we are looking at this nice picture of the topology of our infrastructure, but we never really have that. Like, these are web apps that have, tens of thousands of lines of code, and they might be making a request anywhere in that code to any other system. So we don't have this picture. We might have an informal one. We might sort of draw it in the whiteboard. We're not even 100% sure that, as developers, we're not 100% sure that that is accurate. We might be wrong. But also our tools, our automated tools, you know, it's kind of annoying if like a developer has to input this, even if they happen to be correct. So how can we get this picture? How can we do this if we don't have this picture? So, okay. So this is the end of the first part. I just wanted to make a couple of points. I'm not going to be talking about cycles or dynamic graphs. Dynamic graphs might happen, for instance, with webhooks. You make a request to a service, and you give it a URL, and sometimes it's what request it makes afterwards depends on that value, right? I'm not going to talk about those two things. They don't really change any of the picture in any important way. That just would make the talk longer. I'm not going to talk about persistence because it would make the talk a lot longer. It's like a two or three other talks. Yeah. Okay. So now we have an idea of the problem space, a slight improvement or a big improvement sometimes in the potential solution. How do we implement it? So we're going to take inspiration from Nix, a project that's primarily addressing a seemingly quite different problem space. And here's a quick introduction to Nix. Again, this is a very biased introduction. It won't actually help you that much with Nix, but it will help you insofar as this talk is concerned. So this is a simple script. What does it do? It doesn't really matter, but you know, it finds every markdown file in the current directory and replaces foo with bar in it, and then writes that file back. Here we have several executables that when whoever wrote the script was expecting to exist in the system that runs it, right? So the bash bin slash bash, that's presumably something I can interpret this script, right? So the dependency is that I expect slash bin slash bash to be a file, and that file to be a version of bash that makes sense with this. I also expect find, and I missed sh, but find, sh, sed, sponge, all of those things, I expect those things to be in the path variable, right? So I expect there to be a path variable that has a bunch of directories, and within one of those directories, I expect to find, and sponge, and whatnot. And I expect those things to be executables that make sense, right, for my purposes. I expect them to actually be the find executable. And presumably, actually, probably the right version of the find executable, because with with this world, there's always incompatibilities, right? Like if you're on a Mac, probably one of those flags is different. I don't know. So that's kind of annoying, right? But let's redraw this a little bit in a more suggestive way, right? So I mean, this script is asking the path variable, hey, give me find. And then from in response to that, it's asking the file system, hey, give me the executable find and sed and sponge and whatever it is. This is kind of just to be a bit more suggestive. It's not that good a picture of what's actually happening, but just to sort of pump our intuitions about the similarities. So this is problematic, right? The fact that there are all these implicit dependencies is problematic. It might be that someone doesn't have Sponge installed. So when they try to run the script, it doesn't work. It might be that they have their own version of Sponge installed. So it all works in a completely different way. Potentially it's even worse. To fix this, the first thing we're going to do is get rid of the path variable. Just reference all the executables directly by path. So we can do that, right? Let's just assume that they're all in slash bin. So now it can't happen that someone changes the path variable and then screws everything up, because we're not using it anymore. But it can still happen that someone changes what slash bin slash find is, and then screws this up again, right? And this happens very naturally because maybe there's a system upgrade or some other script needs a different version, so you go and upgrade that and you break this script. So what we do, we then rename all the files so that they contain the hash of the source code. So the version of bash is gonna have a hash. We remove all the items in /bin that don't have a hash, and we only allow the ones that have a hash there. And the hash is gonna be the hash of the source code that built this, right? So we do the same thing with the script itself. It now has a hash, which is this, the hash of this, right? So now if there's a version of find and another version of find, they can coexist, it doesn't matter. We don't let anyone sort of change this unless it happens to be for something with exactly the same hash code as the same source. So we get rid of all these problems, right? In practice, rather than asking you to write that horrible thing, what you do is you use these special interpolation variables or whatever at a sort of build step. Nix will replace these with the hashes that you wanted, right? It could be this is a very simple build step, and Nix, you know, the build steps can be much more complicated, but this is the crucial part for us, right? Does this make sense? Yeah. Okay. So, importantly, I made a mistake here, but it's a useful mistake. SH doesn't have the hash thing. So what I said was that there are no more files, there's no more path, and there are no more files without a hash. So this is going to fail because that doesn't exist. And that's important. Why is it important? Because we know that for any script, all of the executables that it uses, we know it statically. In this build step, we did all the replacements. No one's going to put this random thing in the source code. That's kind of the assumption. No one's going to be crazy enough to do that. They're all going to use those variables over there. So at the build step, we know exactly what the dependencies are. Does that make sense? You can't reference find any other way than with a hash, because there is no other find than the hash ones. And the only practical, the hashes, by the way, are much longer. The only way of you're going to do that is by using this system here. Okay, so this is, again, a more suggestive way of looking at this. We have the script. It's referencing a bunch of things. If we want to change the version of sponge that it uses, you know, we have that version of sponge. We now have a new version of the script that references the old versions of everything else. The hash is different because the source code of the script is different. And then, you know, this external world here might be your shell. You know, in your shell, you use something like script.sh rather than script, you know, use bash or find or whatever it is. But they sort of resolve to something different potentially. And so when we're done building this and happy with it, we switch the shell to reference this instead. And we might, as an extra step, realize that nothing is pointing to that. So we can garbage collect that. And we might realize that nothing's pointing to this version of sponge, so we can garbage collect that as well. And that's how an upgrade happened. Okay, so presumably, at least vaguely, the similarity between these problems is becoming a bit clearer. So this is roughly what the syntax that I'm thinking of, but the idea is that your services, they're not gonna use URLs in the traditional way, in the traditional sense, to talk to one another. They're gonna use URLs with hashes. And the hashes are the hash of the source code of the service that they want to talk to. And so you can have the variable interpolation or whatever in a similar way. If you're familiar with Nix, the syntax will make a bit more sense, but otherwise, the only important part is that anywhere in your source code, if you want to talk to one of these services, you have to use this variable interpolation because you're not going to be able to guess their hashes otherwise. And so at the build step, we know that we know the dependency graph. So each version is going to get a name, right? So you kind of have the pets over there just so it's a little bit easier in the logs to figure out which service it is. But there's only that name. And there's a nice idea here about, basically this, the same text came up in garbage collection, in reference to garbage collection a couple of talks ago, right? This is not just a relatively simple garbage collection task to know when to shut down the system, because you have the entire topology, the graph of the system. Because not having the topology of the system not only didn't allow you to do the basic thing that we wanted, which is just deploy the basic the minimum subset, but it didn't even let you figure out how to shut down gracefully while handling all these things, because you don't know, if this system is still alive, does this mean that I can send a request to this system? So do you have to keep this alive? You don't know. So the shutdown system is also much nicer. So what happens is exactly what we talked about before. We deploy these three systems, right? And so there are a couple of this is true of the script before and of the Nix world, and it's true here as well. Each service is only going to talk to one service. So you can look at the hash of the, so if you're talking to abd1/best.com, implicitly you also know what version of the downstream service this system is talking to. So that's quite nice for the logs as well, and if something goes wrong, you can sort of reconstruct its entire world just from that bit of information. How do we do? There is no downtime, we pass the request. The fast efficient deploys, backwards compatible changes are the pre-deployment and the signage checks and all those are going to be, as we talked about before, those we did okay on. The fast efficient deploys, it sort of depends, right? Because this is kind of, presumably you notice that this is very much like a system data structure, right? When you change something in a list, for instance, what do you have to, what stays and what's new? That's intuitively how much you have to redeploy. Depending on what your graph, what your topology actually looks like, you might have to redeploy almost as much as if it were the entire system, or much less, right? It'll vary based on which service you're redeploying and what your topology looks like. Whether this is much better or just a little bit better will vary from case to case. One thing I didn't mention is it can, let's say that you redeploy the system and the way in which you do checks you have a QA, so you redeploy the system and you're going to do some checks, right? It could be some automated checks or it could be manual checks. And what you visit the website and click on a couple of things. And what does that mean? Well, it means that this makes a request to this and this makes a request to this. You can, in that case, for instance, do something like record what the conversation between these two systems were. And then when you redeploy the system, you just replay this conversation over here and say, actually, all the replies were exactly the same. So I know that insofar as this test is concerned, I don't actually need to redeploy this. So getting into more detail about how this is more complicated. It has a lot of corner cases. Getting into details about how you might actually safely say, no, I want to just redeploy this, and I don't have to redeploy the upstream ones, and I can still get the guarantees that I wanted, that the entire system is going to function well, that's still possible. But that's more work. Here we just sort of maybe approximately halved, in this case, the number of systems deployed. Yeah, So I think that's it. This is roughly the idea. Thanks a lot. Are there any questions? I would be interested how this looks in practice. Where are the places you can implement these hashes? Is it just URLs, or where does it apply?
Yeah. So one thing that I forgot to mention just before I answer is, one big advantage of the system as well is just the sort of infrastructural simplicity. If you look at something like Kubernetes or whatever, right, there's so many other bits of software that are running in your infrastructure besides the one that you're deploying consciously to get everything working, precisely because of this sort of networking changes and, I don't know, rolling from one system to another. And this, because you get a lot more information statically, you can actually get rid of those runtime bits of software. So what's happening with the URL? The URL, the idea is that it's just a DNS thing, right? It's just tell the DNS, hey, there's a new service, and this is the URL. But of course, you could choose to do this in other ways as well, with a proxy in between or a service mesh of a different type.
You change the URL only in the DNS, not in the services connecting to the URL.
Exactly. So you only change, so you never change anything, right? But you inform the DNS of a new URL, right? So that's also kind of nice because you get to use DNS a little bit more safely and a little bit less annoyingly, right? So you can actually use, Kubernetes deploys its own DNS service into your system. Whereas here, I believe, I haven't tested this, by the way, this is in a half-half state. It's like, I would say that about maybe 30% of it's implemented and I'm testing it. But a lot of it isn't. But if people want to play with it, come talk to me afterwards. With DNS, there's this problem where there's a lot of caching, right? So if you want to change, if you want to update things, it takes a long time. Which means that people tend to not use DNS for a lot of situations because they need quick updates. So then you maybe get a proxy in between, right? And that is much faster. But now the proxy is handling all of your traffic, right? Whatever traffic is going somewhere is passing through that proxy, which is the problem. In this system, because you don't ever update DNS entries, you just you just create them, much of this problem is gone, I believe.
Next question? Yeah, so I have a question. As far as I understand, hash is based on the entire code, not on the hash of public API of the service, right?
So it's the entire code, but the code will contain the hash of any systems that you talk to. Does that make sense? Because if one system is talking to another system, it needs to use the URL, which is a hash, of that system, right?
Yeah, because my current understanding if the code changes, then the hash of the server changes. The API, public API, could probably not be changed. And you have to redeploy everything both upstream or downstream from the server.
I realize I didn't make this very clear. If the hash of this changes, right? There's a new version of the service. The hash of this service is also going to change, but the hash of that one isn't. Because somewhere in the source code of this service, you have a $ substitution with the URL of this service, but that value, what gets interpolated, is now a different one because the hash of this service is different. So now the hash of this service is also different. So that means that it also gets redeployed to a new world. And then the same over here. But that's not true here, right? Because those two systems don't have in their source code a hash to any of these other systems.
The hash of the dependency in the source code will never get out of sync with the hash of actually deployed
Exactly, because it's part of a build system, as it were, to convert basically this syntax, right, where you're not actually mentioning the hash, but you're using a sort of substitution variable. And so whenever this value over here changes, then this people app component as well will change. So it never gets out of sync because in the source code you reference a nice name, and then the system keeps track of whether a new hash, whether what it refers to has changed, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. It's really nice how you got idea for infrastructure out of looking at Nix and looking at what Nix is really well. But I fear that you also get the problems that Nix is, well, maybe not doing bad, but they don't have an answer. And the one that bothers me here is state. So Nix is great for configuring all the mutable parts of my system, but it doesn't really help me at all of dealing with the statefulness of the system. And you said you don't want to go there, but maybe you can say a few words about how persistence and stateful things play a role here. So I have some thoughts, but none of them are super convincing here. One of the things that's interesting about state is it's a little bit like OOP ID, right? It's that identity that changes over time, that's how I want to reference it. Like if I have a database, I don't want to reference the state of the database at that moment in time and then redeploy to that state. I want to reference that database and whatever data is in there. Intuitively there are two different types of ID here, but what's even more interesting is that these two systems sort of interact, right? So with with checkpointing and cloning and in file systems and DFS and whatnot, right? You can duplicate a state, so you can also reference the state at that moment in time, but probably not by hash, but maybe by hash as well. So then and presumably that could be useful, right? Because in this Kinesis CI and is now going in the direction of hosting as well. But when you do testing, very often one thing that could be useful is for instance, with migrations, right? You very often when you write migrations, you write a migration and it works locally because you have no data in your database. And you try deploying it and it doesn't work anymore because there's data there. So what would be nice is if you can say, okay, as part of this test, duplicate whatever data is in the live production website or whatever, try to run this migration. So then you kind of want to be able to reference databases or persistent things in both these ways, right? And I've been thinking a lot about how you could do that. There's some intuition about maybe being able to reference the previous deploy or something like that. So it kind of looks like a state monad of some sort or whatever, but I if you have ideas, please share.
Another short one, the last one. And as far as I understand, with such an approach, if there is no consistent effort of updating dependencies, assuming you have multiple things with lots of microservices, you will end up with the same situation as in the Nix. So you have lots of copies of intermediate small services, right?
Yeah, although Nix, you can garbage collect them, right?
Yeah, they are being garbage collected if they are not referenced, but they will be referenced if, for example, imagine you have a team. The team manages the service, but there are not many real business logic updates, but they need to constantly update hashes of their dependencies. To force garbage collection of the older versions.
The deployment's a little bit different, right? Because if usually in this sort of microservice deploy infrastructures, you have one team that's responsible for one service or a couple of service, and then you have another team and they deploy things completely separately. Here, and team A and team B responsible for services A and B. If team A deploys, they only deploy service A. Whereas here, I deploy service A, but that triggers potentially a redeploy of service B as well, even though the team didn't do anything about it. Right? Because that bit, usually the configuration or whatever, the system notices that that the hash of B has to also change. So you can't continue referencing the old version if there's a new version that's being deployed. Unless you choose to in a more deliberate way, unless you say, okay, like, well, you know, make this available in a different URL or something.